Would you like to attend a U.S., perhaps U.K., master's or Ph.D. program in a STEM field? Whether you reside in any one of those countries or outside one of those countries, are you concerned about the process of both applying to and then completing the degree? Have no fear. Our guest today is going to lay it all out for you.
Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. Your host is Accepted's founder and world-renowned admissions guru, Linda Abraham. At Accepted, our mission is to get you to that unforgettable moment when you read your acceptance email and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" Confident you'll be attending the perfect program to help you launch the career of your dreams.
Welcome to the 410th episode of Admission Straight Talk, Accepted's podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Before we dive into today's interview, I want to mention a free resource at Accepted that can benefit you if you are applying to graduate engineering programs. That resource is Applying to Graduate Engineering Programs, What You Need to Know. And it can guide you through a process you've never been through before. It's not the same as applying to college. Download your complimentary copy at accepted.com/410download. Again, that's accepted.com/410download to get Applying to Graduate Engineering Programs, What You Need to Know. It gives me great pleasure to have on Admission Straight Talk for the first time, Dr. Eva Lansoft, citizen of the world, professor of civil engineering, blogger, and podcast host. Dr. Lansoft was born in Belgium, earned her bachelor's in civil engineering in Brussels, and her master's in structural engineering at Georgia Tech with a Fulbright scholarship and a scholarship from the Belgian American Educational Foundation. She earned her PhD at TU Delft, where she has been a researcher since earning her PhD in 2013 and recently received tenure. Since 2013, she has also been an assistant professor at USFQ in Quito, Ecuador, where she also has tenure. Eva, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you so much for having me, Linda. I'm delighted to be here today.
My pleasure. Now, I've just given a really quick overview of your career. Officially, You're a professor of civil engineering with a focus on concrete. However, you've been blogging and podcasting about something not so concrete, and that is how to get into and complete PhD programs. How did you get interested in this process?
Sure. So I started blogging in the first year of my PhD, and at that time, I was just documenting my experiences mostly in the laboratory. I wanted a place where I could write about what didn't work in the lab or the processes behind what we do in the lab, like how to keep lab notes, how to organize all that information, things that don't get into a journal publication. So I started to use my blog as a space for documenting those things. And as I progressed through my career, I started to write about other topics related to PhD research and PhD education. And then came questions from students thinking about doing a PhD. What is it like? What should I consider? How do I select a school? How do I select an advisor? What is different with a PhD in the Netherlands versus the United States, etc.? So I started to write about all of these topics, and that's how I've been addressing these topics about admissions and the program of PhD.
It's absolutely fascinating. So I guess you saw an unmet need and decided to meet it.
Yes, I think there's a lot of information out there, but I found that especially in my niche of engineering and civil engineering, there may not be that many professor bloggers or PhD student bloggers out there. And I guess I stepped up to the lag that was there and started to address those. And from those questions came my interest in really looking at what is the PhD program like at different universities and why are there these differences and how does that then impact the career of researchers after going through more research-oriented or more coursework and research PhD program?
I mean, all PhD programs at this point have research, and that's a fundamental,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
What is a typical process for, and again, I'm sure you can go into enormous depth here, but what is a typical process for earning a PhD in a STEM field?
It also really depends on the country, but mostly I've worked in the Netherlands. So what I see is that it is a typically, if it's full-time, it will be a 3 to 4 year endeavor. If you do it part-time, of course, it takes at least 5 years. There will always be a time of reading, familiarizing with the literature, defining what is really going to be your research question, the topic that you really want to address. And from that comes then the methods that you will apply. And in a STEM field, that typically has either a theoretical component or an experimental component, or that experimental component can be physically in the lab or it can be numerical experiments. So that requires typically a large amount of time of either bench work or computer simulation work or a deep theoretical analysis. And from there then comes the interacting with the data, wrapping up everything, getting back to your research question, and then writing the dissertation and defending at the end.
What if a PhD student has a hypothesis? I assume most of this research is based on the idea that you're testing a hypothesis, and the test shows that the hypothesis is false. I'm sure this happened.
Yes, and I do a lot of experimental work, so I am very well aware of all the surprises one can get in the lab. And there's a lot of things that can happen. It could be that your experimental design is not correct, that you are finding something different in there, or that you are measuring not the correct quantity to address your research question, or that, or you can really be finding something completely new and showing that everything we've known before cannot be extrapolated to this particular case. So it is very common, and it's important then to figure out for a PhD student what's really the reason for this finding. And of course, that can be very difficult. But going through the basics first, the experimental design, the set of parameters that you use, all of that. And from there, see, oh, did I really find something that nobody else found before? Well, that's really exciting. So I wouldn't get too disheartened. I understand that if something happens unexpected in the lab, it can be shocking, right? You're like, I've done all this reading. I think I know what's going to happen, and something completely different happens. And it still happens in my field, in my experiments. Sure. Sometimes different failure mechanisms occur, for example. And then I get excited because then we're finding something new. But I do understand that if you're just starting to do experimental research and you may be like, oh, what happened here? And maybe everything I've been doing was wrong. So in short, I would say cover your bases, make sure that the experiment is properly designed. And from there, see if you are finding something new, and then link it back to theory.
Isn't there a famous story told about Thomas Edison as he was doing experiments to determine what's a good filament for the light bulb? He went through hundreds of variations, and somebody asked him, didn't you get frustrated? Why didn't you give up after the, I don't know how many, I think he did like 1,000 different experiments, didn't he? And he said, no, I knew that every single time I was getting closer to the right one.
That is a perfect illustration.
It's a famous story. Yes, I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Yes. And it is a perfect illustration. And I'm taking a mental note that next time that a student is a little bit disheartened about something in the lab, that I will bring that up.
All right. Let's go back to the applicant. Okay. Let's say I'm an undergrad and I know I want to get a PhD in a specific field. I even have an interest area, research interest that I have. Do I have to get a master's first? And if so, should I get a master's that requires a research and a thesis? Should I save my interest for my PhD? Or should I try and take classes as an undergrad that require research and go directly to a PhD? What would you advise that undergrad?
That's an excellent question. And the short answer to that is it depends.
Okay. It's an answer I give frequently.
Yes. So it really depends on if I hear that you already have there or that the student has identified that the topic, and that probably will mean as well a university and a professor to work with. So in that case, it would really depend on the requirements of that university. If you can enroll into a master's that then immediately continues into a PhD, then that may be the right way to go. Or if you're already interested in research, I would say start doing research as an undergraduate with a professor at your undergraduate institution and talk with them on what they recommend. So they may say, well, if you aim for that university, perhaps it would be good to go to a master's somewhere else, get this particular experience that they may not have there, and then have a larger chance of being an excellent contributor where you want to go do your PhD.
Okay. Now, what is the typical application process for a PhD applicant?
That also really depends on the university and the country. And in the United States, that is a very standardized process than through websites, whereas in the Netherlands, it may be the way I got into my PhD program was by cold emailing a professor and saying, really? I saw this on the website and I'm interested. And that's really the only professor I emailed for a PhD position. And wow. He didn't answer for a month. And then he answered and said, oh, yeah, we are still looking for one PhD student. Send your CV and we'll talk. So I know that I'm very lucky there because I get cold emails from applicants pretty much every day now. And I get so overwhelmed with emails that I can't even politely decline. So I'm very sorry to say that, but I just delete most of them, unfortunately. And I guess that's what most people do. And so for us, it's really when we have a project, that project is funded, and then we start to look for the person.
You don't advertise for the person. You would just indicate on your website, I assume, that applications are open for a PhD with this research interest. Is that basically mm-hmm. what it would be?
In some cases, they get advertised on the website of like the vacancies of university. But in some cases, especially when we are on tight schedules for funding, we will either just ask some of our recent master students if they are interested or just reach out to colleagues saying, hey, do you have a student who just did a master's in the lab and would be willing to continue? Or we share it within our own networks. And that's the time when a cold email would land very well. But of course, that's a lottery.
Now, in the U.S., I think it's a much more formalized process. Am I correct?
Yes, yes, yes.
And so can you give an overview of that?
Sure. I did my master's at Georgia Tech. So I went through the whole procedure of applying to universities there, as well as applying for the Fulbright and the Belgian American Educational Foundation. And those are very standardized processes where you take standardized tests, such as the TOEFL and, in my case, the GRE. In other fields, that would be the GMAT. And you put together your application package with your letters of recommendations from your professors, with your statement of purpose, your autobiographical essay, those parts. So it is a much more standardized process. And it may be, especially for foreign students, I was in Belgium at that time, where these types of applications do not exist. So for me, it was a bit of a learning curve on how do I write these essays and all that.
Yeah.
But once I got the hang of it, then I knew, okay, it's the same for all the schools. So I can pretty much process them all together.
Need to tweak them a little bit for the individual schools.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
But no, we work with our clients on that a lot. So abroad, outside the U.S. or certainly in Europe, it seems like it's a little less standardized. I don't know about South America. In the U.S., it's much more standardized. How important is fit with the advisor?
Again, it depends. Okay. I think for a master's program, especially if you're going to do coursework with perhaps a thesis or the first semesters will be fully coursework, then you may still have a very vague idea of what your research would be like. And I think then it's, of course, identifying the people that are important to work with and having some direction is helpful. But at the PhD level, I think there it becomes much more important. And knowing for yourself as well, if you want to work with an assistant professor who may have less resources, but may have much more drive to publish and get tenure and all that, or to land in an established lab where you may be with more other PhD students, have more resources, but where your supervisor may be much more hands-off. So I think it's really there seeing somebody's career level and what would fit you and your learning style is quite important there.
Yeah, I think you're raising some great points. Another point I think that we get asked sometimes or that I see applicants questioning is the role of the university's reputation and brand versus specific strength, usually a specific professor's strength mm-hmm. in your particular area of interest. So if you're accepted to Harvard, for example, and there's a professor that may talk to you, you know, once a month and mm-hmm. is tangentially related to your area of interest, are you better off going to Harvard or are you better off going to a less well-known university that has a professor or associate professor with studying exactly what you're interested in and mm-hmm. want to pursue? What kind of advice do you have on that?
And I would say it really depends on how you as a student work. So if you are self-directed and you are fine with very limited supervision, and you think, oh, if I go to Harvard and I get those resources, I will talk to the postdocs and the other PhD students and find my way around, then that would be a great opportunity. If on the other hand, you say, I really want to be somebody's apprentice and I want to be side by side and I want to learn as much as possible on this particular topic, I would say then go to the perhaps lesser known university where you could be having a much closer working relationship. And in later career, that very close working relationship can also help you, because if you go somewhere where your supervisor does not have that many PhD candidates, eventually when he or she steps down from any service position or editorial board thing, you may be the person that they will recommend. Whereas if you are one in many, then it's harder to be the one that stands out.
How important is international exposure when pursuing a career in academia, or perhaps going for a PhD that will lead to a career in academia or PhD period? Do PhD programs like to see applicants who've lived in multiple countries or studied, like you in Netherlands and then in the United States? I mean, you've studied in Europe, you've studied and lived and taught on Europe and South America, and also studied in North America in the United States. So you have quite international exposure. And that's just what I know about. There may be other things that I don't know about.
Yeah, I think for me, that was the right decision. But I also understand that, and not for everybody personally, that can be the right decision. Now, any international exposure is good to shake up your thoughts.
It's enriching. It enriches you as a human being.
Yes. Not just working in a different working environment or seeing a different school of thought helps you to be able to see a problem from different angles. And I think that is really something that I've appreciated from going through different countries and seeing different ways that engineering is being thought and different, like Belgium is very mathematical. Every engineering problem would be written out as a differential equation or something like that. And we see things very mathematical. Whereas in the United States, engineering is very hands-on, very practical. And then in the Netherlands, it is also more practical, but then very entrepreneurial as well. So I've appreciated those different angles in being in these different places and learning from that. But I also understand that there's many family situations, personal situations where that may not be the right decision, and that committing to a full study abroad may not be the right thing for you. But there's always opportunities to go for a short term. So you could always be a shorter amount of time abroad. And I think especially for PhD students who may already have some work experience and already have a family and their house and everything, that it's not the right time and season in their life to move to another country and shake everything up. But then still, if they have the opportunity to go for 6 weeks to another lab, that would still be very enriching. So I wouldn't write it off completely, but see what would be a right fit for the right person.
Makes sense. Sounds like it's a nice to have, but not required.
Indeed, yes.
What do you think would surprise international applicants to U.S. MS or PhD programs? We work with a lot of international applicants.
Mm-hmm. What surprised me was the level of standardization, as I mentioned before. In Belgium and in the Netherlands, things are much more haphazard especially at the PhD level. When I did my first master's in Belgium, it flowed directly from the bachelor, so there was no cut in between and no application process. So the level of standardization was something that surprised me. I hadn't done standardized testing in I don't know how long. So that was, had to get used to it again. And I have my own ideas about that, but it's one of the things that are part of it. So you got to practice for it and do your best and rise to the occasion of it. Then I was also surprised to see the difference between the schools that even though they all offer, I was looking for a master's in structural engineering at the time, mm-hmm. and I was interested in concrete structures. But of course, every university has its own special sauce because they have their own research that they do. So I was coming from a small country we didn't even have a concrete professor at the University of Brussels. He was from another university. So just seeing that there's so many people working on the topic in a large country like the United States was for me a big surprise.
One of the things that I've noticed that sometimes internationals struggle with when applying to US programs, and correct me if I'm wrong or if you have a different view of it, is that apparently many times outside the United States, especially in Asia, I think, it's very much your test scores and your grades, or just your grades. And the concept of other qualities being sought by graduate school is just foreign. Mm-hmm. It's very simply foreign. So I think also on the PhD level, it may count a little bit less than on, for some other graduate programs, but I still think that's something that internationals struggle with. Did you have the same experience, or what are your thoughts on that? The idea that you have to do a statement of purpose and a personal biography. What does it matter if I get the grades? Who cares?
I think in my case, I've always been a little bit of an odd duck. So for me, I think it was one of my strengths. I've always been very active as a musician as well. So that's also something that I wrote on my autobiographical essay. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I went to interview for my BAEF, Belgian American Educational mm-hmm. Foundation Scholarship, that one of the jury members said, oh yeah, you're that engineer musician, right? So I knew at that time, like, oh yeah, that's the thing that stuck with them. And that's also something that now I tell my students when they apply to go do their master's in the United States. Your scores are excellent. Your GPA is great. You're going to be at the same level as all the other 3.8, 3.9 GPA students from all the rest of the world. So show them who you are, what makes you you, what makes you unique. So I think that is really what a professor looks for as well, right? You're still working with another human being.
Absolutely. That's great advice. That's just great advice. Now, if you were to look at, let's say, UK programs, PhD programs, we've touched mm-hmm. on some European ones, obviously. What would surprise somebody applying, let's say, to a UK program or a South American program?
When it comes to the UK, then, of course, it's very different from continental Europe. And I think we need to acknowledge that as well, that there is a very large difference in the nature of the PhD as well as in its defense. I'm currently working on a book on the topic of the PhD defense, and the Viva from the United Kingdom is very different from the defense in different parts of the world. So the traditional, and there is variations of the Viva in the United Kingdom, but typically it will be a closed examination. So the defense in the Netherlands, for example, you can bring your friends and family, and in the United States, you can bring your friends and family. There may be a part where you're just alone with the committee, but your presentation is open to everybody. In the United Kingdom, this is going to be closed, and you typically have an external and internal examiner. In the traditional sense of the Viva, you are in a room closed off with just these two people that grill you, and that will then give a recommendation on your defense as or Viva, as well as your PhD thesis. Whereas, for example, in the Netherlands, you have a committee of a lot of people, which will include your promoter or supervisor as well. There are variations in the UK where the supervisor can be in the room to take notes, but not ask questions. And in some cases, there will be a chair of the department as well to make sure everything kind of follows the rules. But traditionally, it's just an internal and external examiner in a closed room with a PhD candidate that can be a very difficult exam to pass.
Whereas, sounds intimidating.
Yes. Whereas in the Netherlands, for example, we have these committees of 8 people. They're very ceremonial, the defense. So you have the it's called the beadle, and that is a person who has a ceremonial role in university. So they have a full regalia and a very long stick, and they come in with the committee. They place the committee in their place, then they go back. And after exactly 1 hour, they come in and they tap the floor with that stick and say, "Ora est," it is the hour, and then you're supposed to enter defense. So it's very, very ceremonial, caps and gowns and everything, standard sentences to address the PhD candidate, take off the hat or put on the hat. There's very, very strict protocol. There's only one room in university that can be used for the defense. So it's very, very ceremonial, very medieval times.
It sounds like it. Fascinating.
So it's a very different atmosphere. It's even though it's still a defense, you still get grilled. You're still nervous. It also has that very ceremonial and celebratory aspect to it. And really with the caps and gowns and
Is the conclusion, is the outcome for sure that you're going to get the PhD? Even is the defense more of a ritual than a reality?
Yes, because you get the degree. You get the degree at the end of that. After that hour, the committee will sign, and then you get your degree. So it really is the commencement and defense all rolled together.
So it's the culmination, not one more step on the way.
Yes.
Wow,
yes.
That is a big difference. I had no idea. It sounds fascinating.
Then the months before, the going back and forth with the committee is really the time defense. That it takes to get the thesis up to speed.
Got it. Mm-hmm. That is fascinating. What are some of the non-scientific skills? Now, we mentioned how the U.S. schools in particular were interested in the fact that you love music, okay? But are there non-scientific skills that you need to succeed in a PhD program and in academia?
Mm-hmm. I think these are very important. People tend to say that your publications are the currency of your academic career. And in order to get to the point of getting your work publishable, you will need to be able to write in a clear manner and make good figures and present visual information in a clear way. And these are things that typically are not taught in engineering school. So those are very important skills. And if somebody has never had a course like that, you can still, when you are in graduate school, to hone those skills. I had the chance of taking a course on writing and presenting during my master's at Georgia Tech, and I still credit that course to a lot of what came afterwards as successes in my career, because in that class, I really learned how to write clearly and how to present formulas and complex mathematical elements in a clear way that the audience could follow. And I think those are such important skills.
That's great. Great input. What are your top tips for getting funding for PhDs? Because that's obviously critical.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It depends on the program as well. For example, if you go to the Netherlands, you may be hired on a funded project. And then that is different from going somewhere with funding, either from your home country, an institution such as a Fulbright, or getting an excellent scholarship, or any of these opportunities. Again, when you apply to scholarships where you are, say, if I am an engineer interested in concrete and I'm up to somebody who is going to work on cancer research or baby hearts, as I try to often say, maybe my research will be the less attractive to a committee because, you know, concrete is gray and boring.
I'm in Los Angeles where, you know, you have a lot of earthquakes, so concrete is a little bit less boring.
Yeah. You want it to behave properly.
You want it to behave in an earthquake, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Or you want the engineers who designed it to have taken into account.
A little give there helps a lot, you know?
Yes.
I live actually very near to a place where the freeway actually fell down, and tragically, in the 1994 earthquake. But and I always try and get out from under that underpass. Mm-hmm. But anyways, what are some of your top tips for getting funding, other than not going against, a sexier kind of proposal? That's pretty much what you're saying.
Well, I think the relevance lies in your story, right? That there is always a value to society to what you do. And I think if you can show the impact that your work can have, and in my case, concrete is the second most used material in the world after water. So the possibility of impact there is very large. We just look around yourself and try to think away everything that is concrete and not much would be left standing. Sure. So it's still important. And I think finding the thing that connects to people and connects to funding bodies and committees by showing beyond, you know, your mathematical model and your experiment, but trying to explain why it's relevant and how you contribute to learning in the world is what's going to help a lot with getting funding.
And that probably goes back to the course you took at Georgia Tech.
Yes, because there I had to learn how to explain what concrete does, or how reinforced and pre-stressed concrete work.
Or how it you'll prevent a freeway from collapsing in an earthquake.
Exactly, yes.
Now, you wrote on your website that your daughter was born, I think, in 2017.
Mm-hmm,
so she must be 3.5 or 4 now. How do you combine your academic career and parenting since she was born?
And I also have a cat, as you may hear, who is now starting to walk around me. Since part of my work is also in the Netherlands and requires a lot of traveling, it took me a bit of learning. Because first I thought I'll just go in the summer, get my research done, and then, you know, pick up being mom again. That's what I thought before having my daughter. And I did that one summer and it was pretty miserable. And that's when I said, well, guess I cannot switch off being mom. And then the next summer that I went to the Netherlands, I just made sure I had arranged childcare in the Netherlands and took her along with me. And I had a bit of fear of going with a toddler in tow. Yeah. And just being on my own with her for 6 weeks and in a tiny apartment and how that all would work out. But I was much happier having her around and sharing some of Europe with her and taking her to see my family. And I think what I'm getting at here is your identity changes as you become a parent. You cannot think in it like I thought I would just flip off being a mom and go work for 6 weeks and then flip on again. Then that's impossible. And I didn't know that. So I think any idea that I had of how I would combine career and motherhood before having my daughter, things turned out different. But I think the importance is finding what works for you. And again, I guess that comes back to my answer of it depends, and find what works for you. If that means finding very good childcare that you can rely on, knowing when it's time to lean into work and when it's time to lean out to work, knowing when it's time to be there for your child. And that's still the most important in life, and work can wait for a moment, and letting things rest when they need to rest and go with the ebb and flow has been what I've been learning these years. And it has brought so much extra value to my life to have my daughter and to see her grow. And I think as a teacher, it inspires me to see how she learns. It inspires me to see how she sees the world and how she sees things. And then it makes me think, oh, yeah, my students, for them, what I teach is all new as well. So I think it has changed me as a teacher, and it also has added a level of purpose to my work. As in, I've always had the feeling that the research that I do is for that contribution to society that I mentioned before, making sure that our bridges are safe and thinking about a way that we can keep using concrete or concrete-like materials in a future where we may not be wanting to use so much cement because of its the amount of CO2 production related to the cement production. Mm-hmm. So it adds a level of purpose to what I'm doing, knowing that my research is going to contribute to hopefully a better world for when she grows up.
Sure. Becoming parent is definitely parent is life-changing. I have at this point, they're all grown, but I have 5 children. And it does change your perspective. There's no question on what you want, what's important. It doesn't mean that you have to give up your career at all. Mm-hmm. But I think, like you said, you can't switch off being a mom. Mm-hmm. And it does, much like going abroad, it enriches.
Yes. Yes.
Right. What would you have liked me to ask you?
That's a good question. Perhaps for a student in Ecuador, what would be good advice for applying, where they should apply to go to graduate school, why they should go to graduate school, from the perspective of having studied in Ecuador, what would be something that would surprise them when they apply to a graduate program?
Go for it.
I've helped a lot of my bachelor thesis students to apply to graduate school in both the United States as well as in Europe. And I think one of the things that's been important for them is to know that even though they are from a small country, they still have a chance. So I think that by now we have a Master of Engineering program in the university where I teach. Well, there is one more in management of immobilia, but not really in structures. Now we have a Master's of Engineering Structures, but for somebody who really wants to go into any of the other fields of civil engineering, very limited in what is available in Ecuador. And that's sometimes considered as in, this is as much as I can learn.
As far as I can go.
Yes, because that's what is available here. And I will take it from here. And I've been challenging my students in trying to break that thought pattern, saying, no, you When I applied from University of Brussels, that's a small school as well, and not many people know that school. And well, I, of course, I'm privileged having grown up in Europe and all that, but any good student can go on to the university where they want to study. So I think the first thing to do there is the work of really believing in yourself. And I've had students with excellent GPAs ask me, do you think I would be good enough for that school? And I just want to tell them, yes, of course you are. So I think that's the most important, to believe in yourself and go for your dreams.
Great advice. The worst thing that happens is they say no. And mm-hmm. you, and then you're right back where you are now. Mm-hmm. You'll never know if you can get in if you don't try. I'm not saying shoot for the moon. You're going to have to show that you can do the work. But for those people who have the excellent grades and are willing mm-hmm. to take the tests and do the work, the universities are very open to international graduate students. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Even touch on Canada.
Yeah. I would say in addition to that, I'm always very impressed by the work ethic of my students here in Ecuador. They are so hardworking. I mean, wow. If I look back at myself when I was a student, I sometimes think like, oh, I was so lazy in comparison. I worked so hard. I hope for more faculty in programs in the United States and Europe to know that then that these students that are at that excellent level, they've gone through a lot of adversity. It's there's just not that much available here for them. And they've done the extra work, they've done all the extra reading to get to that level, and their work ethic is so impressive.
And they will add to the richness of the class when they get mm-hmm. to the foreign university mm-hmm. because they do come from this small country that doesn't send a lot of graduate students abroad mm-hmm. and they will benefit themselves by the enriched. Just living abroad is an incredibly enriching experience. I did a year abroad when I was in school mm-hmm. and I look back on it so fondly. And anybody I've talked to who studied abroad has the same experience or lived abroad mm-hmm. for a certain period of time. Now, obviously, as you correctly noted, there are seasons in life where you're not going to pick up and go and just, well, I feel like spending, you know, 6 months or a year here mm-hmm. or there or whatever. Or you just don't want to. That's okay, too. But for those people who are thinking about it, who have the good reason to do it, have the qualifications, the worst thing is they say no and you stay where you are. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's effort and there's money involved, but gosh, you know, the opportunities and the benefits are enormous. Ava, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. This has been absolutely fascinating. I've really enjoyed it. Where can our listeners find you online? I know you have a blog, you have a podcast. Can you tell us where they can find you?
Yeah, so my website is evalandsoch.com. That's evalandsoch.com. Okay. And there is my blog as well. My podcast is the PhD Talk podcast, which I co-host with Rico Massa from McGill, who is a PhD student. So we have okay. the conversation professor PhD student. And you can also find me on Twitter at evalandsoch, on Instagram at evalandsoch. And my Facebook page is PhD Talk.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you again. We're going to include links in the show notes at accept.com/410 to Ava's website, as well as to her podcast and maybe some of the social media also that she mentioned. And a quick reminder, don't forget to download your free copy of Applying to Graduate Engineering Programs, What You Need to Know at accept.com/410download. Listener, thank you too for joining Dr. Ava Landsoch and me for our 410th episode. I want to invite you also to participate in this month's Thank You for Your Review contest. One listener a month who leaves a podcast review on Apple Podcasts, also known as iTunes, will win a free 20-minute consultation with me. You can leave your review at lovethepodcast.com/AST. Again, that's lovethepodcast.com/AST. I look forward to hearing from you and speaking with you. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.